Morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are in the world. Today is Sunday, February 14th in Melbourne, Australia, where this meeting is based. This is a Design for Living Big Book meeting of Overeaters Anonymous. My name is Penny C, and I'm a recovered, not cured, compulsive overeater and the chairperson for today. To open the meeting, let us have a moment of quiet meditation followed by the Serenity Prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and wisdom to know the difference. We start this meeting by remembering our common purpose to extend the heart and hand of OA fellowship to those who still suffer. Let us be mindful of OA's unity with diversity policy, which respects our differences yet unites us to the solution to our common problem. Whatever problem you may have with food, you are welcome at this meeting. Today is a step speaker meeting. We are delighted to have Melissa C. with us today to share her experience, strength, and hope focused on step two. This month, being February, as I said, we are on step two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves can restore us to sanity. This meeting is being recorded. And now it's my great pleasure to introduce our guest speaker for today. I've known Melissa for some time now, and I will just tell you that she is committed to the 12-step way of life and to service. Melissa, when I asked her, just didn't hesitate. She just said, I'd be happy to do service. And so here she is. And thank you so much, Melissa, and good afternoon.
Yeah, good afternoon. Thank you, Penny. Thanks so much, everybody. It is a pleasure to be here. You know, giving service, it is a delight. It really is. It's not a chore. It's something that I really love doing. And how could I not? Because I'm experiencing a miracle. And when you've experienced a miracle, the desire to share it is overwhelming. It's just there. I can't help but to share, you know, my miracle of healing. So I want to start off with showing my pictures. So I did send them to, right? And you can pull those up for me. I kind of like to talk through those a little bit because it's a real visual demonstration of what a miracle. Well, go to the beginning. Let's go back. Yes. Okay. So I'm going to start here. This is what it looks like for me, what the disease did to me, right? Where I was in a state of utter defeat, powerlessness. You know, the first photo, I had just given birth to my daughter, but I had been morbidly obese for the majority of my life, up and down and up and down and up and down. And when I gave birth to my daughter, I thought for sure I was going to lose that weight and then some. And then if you look at the picture of me in the pink, clearly I got bigger. My daughter got older and I got heavier. And then in the picture next to that, I lost a little weight. And then in the bottom on the red, regained it, right? And then the picture in the sunglasses, I lost some more weight. And the picture next to that, regained it, right? I was constantly going up and down and up and down. And then if you look at the next slide, it continued to get worse. It just continued. Whoop, go back one more. Yes, thank you. But I know this techie stuff. If you can go down one more. Thank you. Okay, perfect. So there, when my son was born, he's younger than my daughter. There's me in the leopard. That was, I believe, at my heaviest. I was over 300 pounds. And I could barely function. I could barely function. The food had beaten me down. And I learned that I am extraordinarily stubborn. And I have a really high threshold for pain because I just kept getting back up and fighting and fighting. You know, in the bottom picture of me in the green, I'm holding a drink. That's me with my sisters, my sister and my sister-in-laws. I come from a large, loving, big family. they all loved me and I felt like a monster standing there next to them. I was, I was drinking because that was about how I got through family events also. And then in the photo of me on the top in the gray, I'm in a dress there. And although I'm heavy there, I had recovered already. My body just hadn't caught up yet. But I remember that event. It was, I made an affair for my daughter, celebrating my daughter's bas mitzvah. And that was the first like affair, first big function that I had made, you know, and went to entirely abstinent. I was paying for this huge buffet, right? And a huge cocktail hour and an open bar. And I didn't have any of it. And I didn't care. I was just joyful to be there. And my body hadn't caught up yet, but that picture was a happy picture. I was truly happy there. And then if you scroll down to the next one, the last slides, photos, that's me, you know, that's going back, in the yellow dress, that's about 5 years ago, maybe 6 years ago. And I'm the same still. I weigh the same, pretty much. I think I've gotten a little smaller, actually. But all those dresses fit me. I can pull them out of my closet and I don't even think about it. And I've never lived that way before. I never knew what was gonna fit me from one day to the next. So those are my photos. And that, you know, should be, maybe a visual. You can exit them now. Thank you so much. Thanks, Joanne. So that's a physical representation of what it looks like to be owned by the disease and live in freedom. And however bad it looked, the physical form, what I was experiencing on the inside was 100 times worse. You know, to have a head full of knowledge and unable to apply that knowledge is painful. I'm a smart woman. I'm pretty bright. You know, I've got a master's degree and then some. I've been able to do lots of great things. I could not do this. And I knew everything there was to know about good nutrition. I even knew what foods caused a problem for me, but I had no ability to apply that knowledge. You know, I didn't lack knowledge. I lacked power. I lacked power to apply the knowledge. So in that time, right, since then, I've released over 160 pounds. I'm less than half of what I was. And I'm free. And that's just, you know, beyond what I could have ever done for myself. So I want to start off, you know, whenever I talk about step two, and I totally forgot to time myself. I'm going to start. Sorry. I'll shave it down a little bit. Okay. So whenever I discuss step two, I have to start off with the necessity for step two, right? That, in step one, in the AA 12 and 12, it states that we have warped our minds into such an obsession for destructive drinking, and for me, destructive eating, that only an act of providence can remove it from us. So that means that the only chance of living with something that's permanent, progressive, and fatal, and add patient, right? Because it's patient too, is an act of providence, meaning we need a miracle. That is it. We are people who must experience a miracle, must. You know, in Bill's story on page 8, it says, I had met my match. I had been overwhelmed, you know, and I'll add, food was my master. So step two, you know, is believing that I can be rescued from one master, right? I need to be rescued from the other master, the thing that was mastering me. And the only thing that can rescue someone from something that's mastering you is a power that's greater, is a higher power. Right? So in More About Alcoholism, it ends with this very fact on page 43. It says, once more, the alcoholic at certain times has no effective mental defense against the first drink. I had no defense against the first bite, except in a few rare cases, neither he nor any other human being can provide such a defense. His defense must come from a higher power. That's it. I have a necessity for God. It's what allowed me to have a step two was I needed to have a step two. You know, and to further build on this point, on page 44 in the Agnostics, it says, if when you honestly want to, you find you cannot quit entirely, or if when drinking, you have little control over the amount you take, you are probably alcoholic. If that be the case, you may be suffering from an illness from which only a spiritual experience will conquer. So I have to have this spiritual experience or I will die. That's just the way it is. You know, and in There's a Solution, it says it. I have two alternatives. That's it, two. It's on page 25. This is like one of my go-tos. I have two choices. One, I can go to the bitter end. I can blot out the consciousness, the awareness of how miserable my life is as best I could. And the other is to accept spiritual help. Right? So, and now this brings us right to step two. This is where I land at step two's feet. You know, I came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. And, you know, so many people, I would say, struggle with this concept because all they know is that they've got to have this power. And yet where and how are they going to find this power? Right? And in We Agnostics on page 45, it says, well, that's exactly what this book is about, right? That's what this book's about. It's to enable you to find the power greater than yourself, which will solve your problems, you know? And for many people, and so it means we're gonna have to talk about God. We're gonna have to. And this is where people have difficulty. You know, we talk to a new man, we watch his hope rise when we discuss the alcoholic problem and we explain the fellowship, but the face falls, right? When we speak of spiritual matters, especially when we mention God. And, you know, here there's many reasons why people struggle with God. And, you know, and for the purpose of time, I'm going to try to hit on the ones that apply to me and most commonly with other people that I've sponsored and worked with. You know, and in the book it says some people have a problem because dependence upon a higher power beyond ourselves was somewhat weak and even cowardly. So I actually thought that I was superior to people who had faith. Can you imagine, right? Walking around owned by food, and I was afraid of living without candy. Food was my master. I worshiped diets. That's what I worshiped. I worshiped schemes. I worshiped exercise plans. But somehow in my mind, I was superior to people who believed in God. I thought myself above them. You know, and I also, you know, it would say, it says in the big book that we look upon warring individuals, warring theological systems, and inexplicable calamity with deep skepticism. We looked askance at many individuals who claimed to be godly. So here's where I was. I was quick to point out all the imperfect followers of God, right? I looked at religious people with extremely critical lens. In fact, if you were religious, I looked at you far more critically than if you weren't, right? I claimed that religious people were judgmental. But here I was judging them, you know, of the ultimate criteria if they were religious. And I looked, you know, for me, I suffered some tragedies and I looked at my own tragedies as evidence, you know, of at best an absent God. I thought, then if there's a God, he's not really here. And in my worst moments, I would cry out that God was cruel and I hated him. And I suspected that my feeling was, I thought God maybe hated me right back. And that was really not a comforting way to live, right? That was a really painful existence for me. You know, I love the AA 12 and 12. I think it's very clear, especially in steps one and two. And it says in step two on page 31, more often though, we had met up with some major calamity and to our way of thinking, lost out because God deserted us. And so You know, the problem with this is that I never actually relied on God. I relied on my vision. I had a vision of how things should be. And when I didn't get that, I said that there's no God or that God failed me. But at no time did I seek God's will, you know? And the sad reality, like, here's the truth, is that at one time or another, we're all gonna be met with pain and loss and tragedy. You know, I don't know why, but I know it's the truth. Like, nobody gets a free pass from pain. And I need a faith that works under all conditions. You know, I need a power that I can rely on during my trials, during catastrophes. And just like the work of the steps, you know, what happened is that I rely on God. I come to find God. That's how it works. I actually first have to rely on him in order to find him. And what happened for me is that in time, didn't happen right away. In time, I realized that I was actually able to survive some of the hardest times of my life, not because God abandoned me, right? Because God never abandoned me. And what I realized God did for me was he always placed people and resources right there at my disposal where I needed them. I didn't know that that was God's handiwork, but that was God's handiwork. There was always someone that showed up to guide me through what was a troubling time, right? And all I needed to do was open up my eyes. You know, for me, where did I first feel God's presence? I always loved nature, always. As a young child, you know, I knew that there was something in me that was stirred when I heard a beautiful piece of music. I love music, it always moved me. I always felt like this feeling when I saw like this, a golden harvest moon, you know, it felt like dreamy and beautiful for me, or like a bright sunny day with a gorgeous blue sky. And I knew I didn't create those things. And I knew there was something incredible, magical, beautiful about them. And I wanted to feel that way all the time, but I couldn't maintain it. I couldn't hang on to that connection. And usually for me, something trivial or huge, right? It could be trivial or it could be huge would get in the way of me feeling that, of sustaining that feeling. And now I know today that this is what they mean by being blocked. That's what it means by being blocked from God. And so what was blocking me, right? What were my obstacles? Well, in We Agnostics on page 46, it says, we found that as soon as we were able to lay aside prejudice and express even a willingness to believe in a power greater than ourselves, we commenced to get results. Even though it was impossible for any of us to fully define or comprehend that power, which is God. So one of my greatest obstacles was that I tried to figure out what God was. I thought I needed to understand something in order to rely on it, right? I thought I had to really fully comprehend it. And I think that's a very common scenario. You know, it happens a lot. People get to step two and they think that they're stalled here. They think they can't move forward because they haven't figured out what their God is yet. And I get that a lot. I get that kind of call where people say, you know, I'm struggling. I can't take step two because I can't figure out what God is. And so they think that they're stuck. And in fact, we don't need to ever understand God. That's a misconception. I don't need to understand something intellectually in order to rely on it and believe in the power that exists in it. You know, and I think everybody's heard that analogy of electricity, but I think it's really a good one here. You know, I'm pretty bright, and I'm sure if I took the time and really studied it, I could, but pretty much I don't really understand electricity. I don't understand how turbines work and generators, and they do something, they spin and they whirl around, and then they come through the power somehow on the, you know, in the streets, you see the power and it goes somehow. I know there's a in my basement, right? Downstairs in my basement, I've got a fuse box that I know, like, if things go, I yell for my husband and he'll like flick a switch for me. But I know I have an outlet in my bedroom. I know I have outlets right here, right now. And I don't need to understand any of it to use my lamp, right? Why do I use my lamp? Because I need light. Because I need it and I rely on it because it makes my life easier. And that's, you know, that's really what it starts with God. You know, it's humility I needed, not understanding. I need humility to believe in something that I might not fully comprehend. And I don't need to define it. You know, I need a concept of God that supersedes a fixed concept. You know, I need to have an open mind and a willingness to let this concept evolve. That's what's required. You know, on page 47, it says, when therefore we speak to you of God, you know, we mean your own conception of God. This applies to other spiritual expressions, which you will find in this book. Do not let any prejudice you have against personal terms deter you from honestly asking yourself what they mean to you. At the start, this was all we needed to commence spiritual growth, to affect our first conscious relation with God as we understood him. So there are many paragraphs in this text that I love, right? For me, like, I just love this text. But this one really speaks to me. It's one of the ones that grabs me because it tells me that it's here that we first begin to experience a God consciousness. It's right here that God can begin to enter because I've made room for him, right? He enters where I make some space, and he's so easily available. God is so easily available. All I really need to do is start getting honest and start seeking him. You know, my own attitude was a block to finding God. I used mental gymnastics to outthink God. You know, I've actually said out loud, here was the time I said out loud in my arrogance, you told me in step one that my thinking is broken. Like, I remember saying this. And now you want me to form my own conception, you know, which I took at that time as you want me to make God up. You want me to just make God up now? And basically you want me to use my broken mind to create my own God. And, you know, thankfully, I'll tell you what happened for me. I have a God that loves me so much that he used that as an opportunity to lovingly yet firmly, like, crack my intellectual arrogance open. And, you know, what happened for me was I did begin to have an experience. My father's been gone now. It's going to be 12 years. And I loved my father. I just adored my father. He was just an incredible man. Loving, kind, wonderful. But he would call me out on my stuff. He would tell me, you think you know everything. You know, he would say all the time, you don't know everything. In fact, my dad used to love this expression. He would say, what you know, Melissa, fits in a thimble and there's room to spare, right? And he meant that, like, you know, he wasn't saying it like I'm stupid. He was just saying it like to kind of remind me that I don't know everything. And what happened for me around this time that I was struggling with this God and struggling with morbid obesity, I said that out loud. You want me to make this up? And I heard in my head, I heard my father's voice, and my father was gone already. And I knew it wasn't my father, but it sounded like my dad. And what I heard was, don't be so smart. You want to get better or not, right? You want to get better or not. And you don't know everything. And like, it got my attention, you know, it makes me tear up because it really, I feel like God knows exactly what it takes, right? If only you're willing, if only you're honest and willing. And you know what happened? Like, I was able to lay aside some of my intellectual arrogance because I really did want to get better. Like those words, do you want to get better? I wanted to get better. You know, no. So nobody's telling you what to believe, just to consider believing, right? Just consider believing, keep your mind open, stop debating, you know, and like all great scientists, focus on the evidence, right? Look at the evidence. The evidence tells us that there's been prodigious results, remarkable, impressive, abnormal, huge results, right? Things that could not happen by man's power. Look around at all the people in our fellowship who have had unbelievable results. And that's why I try to show my pictures, because I'm one of those examples. You know, I've had results that did not come from me. You know, what I thought for a long time was this OA thing with its higher power talk was a scam. I was like, this is a hoax. This is a scam. All these people are saying this and they're convincing themselves of it. And it's not really true. Right. And I couldn't allow myself. I was like, I don't want to be tricked into believing a scam. I'm too smart for this nonsense. You know, but this idea was slowly planted in my consciousness. Could you just allow yourself to go with it? Could you just cooperate and go with it? You know, like they say, like drink the Kool-Aid, go with the scam, like buy into it. You know, and what's happened is nothing short of miraculous. You know, and today, like I could happily say that if in fact I've been the victim of a scam or a hoax, it's the best scam ever, right? Couldn't ask for a better scam than this one. Lost 160 pounds, lost the desire for food that once owned me. Every single relationship in my life has improved. I'm a better mother. I'm a better wife. I'm a better daughter. I'm a better sister. I'm a better neighbor. I'm a better friend. I'm a better teacher. I'm saying better, better, better. I have more humility. That sounds so ridiculous because I know that better didn't come from me. It's not my own power that propelled that to happen. You know, I've been able to go through difficulties with peace and a faith that strengthens over time. And so if it's a scam, it is a wonderful scam, you know, and which, by the way, this awesome scam costs me nothing, is available to any human being who honestly wants it and is willing to try. And it's given me a beautiful community, some of the closest friendships, and a life of meaning and purpose. So quite a scam, right? Awful scam. Sounds like I've been hoodwinked. You know, so then we need to ask ourselves one short question, right? Do I now believe, or am I even willing to believe, that there's a power greater than myself? And as soon as a man can say that he does believe or is even willing to believe, we emphatically assure him he's on his way. You know, it's been repeatedly proven among us that among this simple cornerstone, a wonderfully effective spiritual structure can be built. So this tells me that I can actually begin with willingness. Willingness to believe that there's something, right? And I don't think it's an unreasonable starting point for someone who's living in a self-imposed crisis to be willing. You know, so how do I truly come to believe? Meaning, how can I have faith in some higher power? You know, I love the appendix in the back of the book, The Spiritual Experience. And it tells me, it's on page 568, we find no one needs to have difficulty with the spirituality of the program. Willingness, honesty, and open-mindedness are the essentials of recovery. And these are indispensable, meaning can't do without them. And there's a principle which is a bar, right? A blockage against all information, which is proof, against all arguments, and which cannot fail to keep a man in everlasting ignorance. That principle is contempt prior to investigation. So for step two, if you want to have a step two experience, here's what you got to do. One, you have to have willingness. Two, honesty. Three, open-mindedness. Four, you have to start investigating without contempt, right? So if you're investigating without contempt, then you're checking things out with admiration and awe, right? That it's not beneath you to start looking at the miraculous. You know, and to me, it also means that I'm seeking with delight and with the intention of finding. I'm expecting to not only find, but to like the act of seeking, that I'm going to enjoy the seek, and that I'm going to delight in whatever I find. I have to have that attitude about it, you know? And so I love to talk about willingness, which means, and I'm going to sort of like drill into these ideas that I just discussed, willingness, doing things that are suggested, even if you don't want to, right? You want to take step two, start doing things that you're suggested, even if it doesn't sound logical. Willingness is essential. How do we cultivate willingness? How do I get willing? You know, I say willingness is 10 parts desperation, right? Which is the importance of step one. That's the disease's job. You know, and I'll tell you, for me, drive through fast food restaurants, that got me desperate, right? Pay and wait programs that I spent a lot of money, that got me desperate. You know, in I don't know if you guys have this where you are, but in the States, there was a time when I was doing the cabbage soup diet. That was like a common diet here. That one got me really desperate. Lots of, you know, intestinal distress made me really desperate. I took Fen-Phen, that got me desperate. I sat in meetings, right? Here's something that got me desperate. I sat in meetings with an attitude of smug superiority, right? I sat with people who were getting well, and I sat there with this smug superiority because they were talking about God, and I was just too smart for that. I took zero action, and I just kept coming and said, well, I'm praying for willingness. You know, that got me desperate, you know? And the other important component of willingness, which I think we really have to key in on, which is step two, is hope. If you only have desperation, you don't have willingness. You have desperation. But we need hope. Where do I find hope? How do people find hope? Well, that's the purpose of this meeting. That's my job. Right now, my job is to offer hope. Those of you who've recovered, you offer hope. That's your service you do for other people. Those of you who want to recover, go to places where you see demonstrations of hope. You know, look for demonstrations of the miraculous. You know, for me, like nature is a beautiful place. You want to find hope. You know, I love, I have two really great examples to me that are great, you know, demonstrations of hope. One is, I'm a teacher, right? I've been teaching second grade for 24 years and I love it. And nothing gives me greater hope than you see a kid come in who can't read. And then somehow something happens and they make huge academic gains against all odds. I've seen children who live in horrific circumstances and they don't lose their optimism, their bright and sunny attitude, or they take their trials and they turn it into something. I've got the benefit of seeing some of those kids come back years later. That gives me hope, right? Those are hopeful things. And they happen all the time. You know, another beautiful example of hope, I often share it with like friends, especially like people who are struggling in recovery. I had a rotting onion, right? A rotting onion. It was sitting on my counter just this past summer. And my daughter said, let's stick it in water, right? We stuck it in water because this onion started sprouting. It started like blooming. And then it really started coming up and we planted it in the ground. And would you believe a rotting onion grew gorgeous flowers? They looked exotic. They actually looked long. The top was long and these bulbous, beautiful little flowers. And to me, like, that's only God. God takes a stinky onion, something that makes you cry, put it in the ground. You know, that's not my power, but that's a demonstration of hope for me. I search out with the intention of finding miracles. You want to have willingness? Start looking for miracles. I tell people early on in recovery, take out a pencil and paper, a pad, go outside and start looking for the miraculous. Okay, another essential component. to have step two is honesty, right? We're told honesty. If I'm honest, then I'm saying I trust. It's a demonstration of trust. Being honest, we place ourselves in very vulnerable positions. It's the act of the faithful. You know, even saying right at the beginning, I don't believe in God. You know, would you believe that that's actually a demonstration of faith, right? It actually is. Verbalizing it, saying out loud. You know, when a sponsee says at step two that they don't believe in God, you know, and usually here's how it happens. They almost whisper it like it's a secret, like they're the only one. And I think, of course you don't believe in God, you know, or if you do, it's not an effective belief. But verbalizing it, saying it. And sometimes people say, should I just act as if, right? Maybe I should just act, because you hear that sometimes. And I'll tell you in my humble experience, don't act. That's dishonest. Acting is being dishonest. And who are you acting for anyway? Who are you trying to trick? God? Me? You know, yourself? Like nobody's fooled. Instead, you can go to God that you don't believe in with an honest prayer. And I have a friend of mine who shared hers with me, and then I created my own. And I'm going to share hers, and then I'll share mine. So her prayer, her name is Janet, and her prayer is, God, I don't know if you're there. And if you are there, I don't know if you care. But if you're there and you do care, I need help. Right? And that was the prayer that she suggested. And here's the similar one that I have that's based off of hers. Here's mine. God, I don't know that I believe in you. And I don't know if you're interested in helping me, but I know others who believe in you. They assure me that you are real and that you've worked miracles in their lives. And I need one of those miracles too, right? And I say, pray that one for a while and just watch. There will be a change. I've seen it happen. I've seen it change people. Miracles do begin to happen. I've witnessed it, you know? And so honesty, yes, in my prayer, but also honesty in all areas of my life. I have to be honest day one in all areas of my life if I want to form a trusting relationship with God. You know, when I'm honest with my boss, my colleagues, my husband, my kids, what I'm saying is, I trust you, God, with the outcome, right? When I'm dishonest, what I'm saying is, get out of my way, God. I know what's best. I'm not interested in your help, you know, and that's not the position that I need to take if I want help. You know, if you want to believe, then you must first be honest. Okay, open-mindedness. Here's the other aspect of step two. The quality of being willing to consider ideas and opinions that are new or different from your own. Being open-minded means admitting that you aren't all-knowing, right? It means admitting you're not God. And it means believing that whatever truth you might uncover may have more to it than you even realize. So how can we become more open-minded? You know, many people turn to the set-aside prayer. I love the set-aside prayer. There's lots of different versions. Here's the one I like. It's, God, please help me set aside everything I think I know about you. Everything I think I know about myself, everything I think I know about others, and everything I think I know about my own recovery for a new experience in you, God, a new experience in myself, a new experience in my fellows, and a new experience, a much needed experience in my own recovery. Amen. And so I'll tell you, the difference between the set-aside prayer and how I lived, right? For years, my mind, it was wide open to schemes. I loved a scheme. I loved crazy ideas for weight loss. You know, in fact, I always tell people, I had the most open mind for the insane, right? If you presented me when I was in morbid obesity, if you presented me with a crazy diet that made no sense and it cost a lot of money, oh, I was all in. I was like, in fact, my crazy thinking was the more expensive it was, it's got to work, right? You know, the more insane was like, oh, I'm in, I'm all in, right? You know, and, you know, but somehow I was like the miracle of God, that's made up. That I won't believe it, you know? And so like what convinced me, like for God, the food, right? The food convinced me. I was open-minded when I ran out of options. That's really it. When I ran out of options and I attempted, like I said in the beginning, to use my own intelligence and my intelligence failed. It didn't work. You know, it didn't bring me the much power, much needed power. I opened my mind. I'll tell you what happened. I opened my mind a little bit to consider the spiritual side. And I found just that act of humility allowed this power to rush in. You know, God met me where I was at. And that's been my experience, you know. So how do I keep an open mind? Like today, I still have to keep an open mind. You know, I say people, like, if you want to keep an open mind, question your own spiritual beliefs, investigate new ideas, reach out to people, different people. Ask others how they came to believe. You know, try new prayer practices. By the way, you have to start, whether you believe or not, you have to start praying day one. Day one, well, that's willingness. I'll start praying even if I don't believe, and start meditating. I know that's the 11th step, but it's actually 11th step is like where we really begin to get power from it. But step two is where we start it. Practicing it. We've got to start right away. You know, I say stop making assumptions and judgments. If you want to have a step two experience, you have to stop saying things like, I would never, right? That's not an open mind. I just don't relate to, that's not an open mind. Or, yeah, that's just not my thing, right? Again, not an open mind. You know, the other thing that we need for step two is to seek with delight and the intention of finding. And, you know, so step two in the AA 12 and 12, it talks about true humility and an open mind can lead us to faith. And every AA meeting is an assurance that God will restore us to sanity if we rightly relate ourselves to him. So attend meetings with an investigative spirit. You know, when you go to meetings, bring a pad with you, bring a piece of paper with you, ask questions, you know, questioning, not negotiating. There's a difference, right? Asking questions with true humility. When I ask questions, not because I want to confirm my position or support what I already believe, but really within an attitude of investigation, that's seeking with delight. You know, I know that there are people who've been, you know, recovered for 30 some odd years, and they say that they go to every meeting with a pen and paper and they listen for the jewels and they write them down, you know, and they call those people, right? In We Agnostics on page 46, it says, God does not make too hard terms with those who seek him. To us, the realm of the spirit is broad, roomy, all-inclusive, never exclusive to or forbidding to those who earnestly seek. So when I pray and meditate, I do this with an optimistic spirit. I expect to feel God. And I see and feel and look for it, right? I say this, like, if you go outside on a warm summer day and you look on the ground with the intention of finding bugs, you're gonna find bugs, right? If you start scanning the trees with the intention of looking for birds, you find birds. Well, it's the same thing with God. If you look with the intention of finding God, you will see God's presence. You know, for me, like, I love my garden. I love things that grow. I know that that's where God's presence is so powerfully demonstrated for me. You know, I try to embrace the second grader in me. Like, I'm lucky, I teach second graders, and I feel like their enthusiasm is contagious. I think in order to seek God, I can't be jaded. If this is a miraculous creation of my Creator, He doesn't want me to be jaded about His beautiful creation. He wants me to look at it and be filled with awe and enthusiasm. And when I take that position, I feel the nearness of God. I feel Him closer. You know, when I do that, I begin to see the miraculous hand in God. So this is something I usually do with people when I want to demonstrate that you see what you're looking for. And if anybody has their, if they have their AA 12 and 12, you can kind of do this little thing with me, right? I would tell you to take out, you know, you could do it with anything, but I'll do this one specifically. In the AA 12 and 12, on step two, on the bottom of page 27, on the bottom paragraph, there's a beautiful paragraph. It's in the very bottom. And I usually like to tell people, okay, open it up, get there, read it. If you have it, right, open it up, find it. Be ready. Do this like silly little demonstration with me. It says, this is only one man's opinion based on his own experience, of course. I must quickly assure you that AAs tread innumerable paths in their quest for faith. If you don't care for the one that I've suggested, you'll be sure to discover one that suits you if you look and listen. And I just love that paragraph, right? I think it's a beautiful paragraph. Then I usually tell people, okay, now do me a favor. If you found it in the book, now I want you to close it and put it down, right? And I want to, like, this is like the teacher in me. I like demonstrations. All right, do me a favor, put the book down. And I want you to tell me in that paragraph, how many letter A's did you find? How many letter A's did you find, right? And people are like, what? And like, so why is it that you didn't see any letter A's? Surely you know that there are letter A's there. Well, when you were reading that beautiful section, you weren't looking for the letter A. But if I told you beforehand, start looking for it, you would have found it. You would have found them. And that's the same it is with God, right? It's the same thing. If you seek, if you go out into the world, right, with the intention of finding God, if you want to strengthen your faith, if you want to have that step two experience, begin to look at the world with the intention of seeing God. And hopefully that left you with some indication of how you can begin to practice step two. And with that, I'm going to pass.
Thank you so much, Melissa. I appreciate, we all appreciate your being here, and I love you. And now it's time that we go into the question and answer segment. So I'd like to introduce our moderator who will look at the questions and present them to Melissa, and that is Judy.
Here I am. Hi, everybody. Thank you so much, Melissa. My name is Judy, and I'm a compulsive overeater and your moderator for today. Please continue to send your questions on step two to me using the chat, and we'll try to get through as many as possible. Okay, so our first question is, do you have prejudices about God from childhood?
Yeah, of course. You know, yes, yes. I think many of us did. You know, the God that I was supplied with was, you know, my family did their best, but I didn't feel it there. You know, I didn't feel it. We practiced a faith, but it was cultural. our practices were cultural, and they were sufficient for my family. You know, none of them were killing themselves of food. It worked like a charm for them. In fact, some of my family members are quite religious, so they clearly felt God's presence there. So I did, yes, I did. But I've been able to lay those aside, and I can feel, you know, great, you know, I'm grateful. I really can feel God's presence when I'm practicing those religious celebrations with my family now, because I feel closer to them. Thanks.
Thank you so much. And how has it evolved over the years?
I laid aside prejudice is really how it's evolved. So for me, you know, anytime that I went to my family members who are more religious in nature, you know, I used to go there with, first of all, I think it really, how did it really evolve? I think through working the steps, right? Is that with each step, and step four was powerful for me, because I realized I had a lot of resentments against some family members, right? And I blamed God and religion for man, right? For some of the things that people practice, you know, some of the religious family members, they weren't so great, right? And I loved, I had the most critical eye. I could find all their flaws and then blame it easily on their faith and what they believed and practiced. And I think as I did my fourth step and my fifth step, when I realized that was all my own selfishness, my own, you know, resentment, selfish perspective of life, that I was able to lay that aside. And I can hear, you know, like, just like I said, if you look for God, you find God. I can find God there too. Thanks.
Thank you. Did you do any exercises, like written exercises, for the second step?
Yes, absolutely.
And what were they?
Oh my gosh, there's a whole series of work that I do, that I work through. I mean, there's lots of, when I work the steps with people, I do it like I did with readings and writings. And I needed to form my own conception. I needed to sort of write the criteria for God, but I also needed to make sure, like someone had said to me, you can write it, but make sure it's in pencil, because you're going to have to erase it and rewrite it and add more. You know, and today I would say, like, do it on a Google Doc, right? Do it in a Google Doc that you can easily go in and revamp it.
And when you started thinking about a higher power, how did you get it from your head to your heart? How did you start to feel it, actually, rather than just intellectualize it?
In steps, in increments, you know, I love the spiritual experience that it really says for many of us, it is an intellectual, you know, here's the funny thing, right? I had to fire my intellect. And yet I found out, oh, wait a second, I can have an intellectual experience with God, meaning it could be slow and evolving. And I think the addict in me wanted the hit me over the head, bright light moment that was gonna like, pow, you know, and now I'll be recovered. And now I'll never, you know, wanna eat again, and everything's gonna be great. Oh, and by the way, then I'll feel like doing the steps. And it actually is the opposite. It's the opposite. You know, otherwise it would be a two-step, you know, program, and it's 12 steps. So I got it in little glimmers. And I say, like, that's the beauty of working it in steps. Each step led me perfectly, gave me just enough sufficient power that if I didn't delay, if I kept taking step after step, I got infused with greater power, and then it eventually led me there.
Do you have a special name for your higher power?
My creator. I like to say my creator. But I can, you know, I like, I love, you know, love. I say, like, you know, my God is love and my religion is peace. You know, It can be, but I, you know, there's a thing in the book too that I love, and I think it's in step 12. It says like that, that at some point we all come to call it God. We presently call it by its name. And I, you know, I wish I had that passage somewhere because I just shared it with someone. But there's this great AA speaker that says like a lot of, and I love this, like a lot of people come in and they call all sorts of other things God. And they're really quick to tell you what their God is, making sure you understand, don't use that word. Don't use that word, right? Call it something else, call it something else. But most people who have recovery, you know, people who are here 10 years plus, they don't call the doorknob God anymore. They don't call the fellowship God anymore. They don't. Most of them don't. Most of them just say, you know what? I'm going to call it God. You can let it mean whatever you want. I'll let it mean whatever I want, but we can share the name. It's okay. And that's sort of how it evolves. I call it God. It's easy.
Do you refer to it as a gender at all, or does that bother you?
None of it bothers me.
Okay.
None of it. No, I'd probably say he, because it's, you know, but I don't, I'm not offended if someone says she, doesn't matter.
And if things happen in your life, like tragedies, do you then struggle with conscious contact or with a relationship with a higher power? How does it affect it?
Yeah, so I'll tell you, I actually have had some powerful spiritual experiences in the midst of tragedy, for real. I, you know, there was a few years back, my daughter had tremendous difficulties, and, you know, I was driving behind an ambulance, following the ambulance. She was going to a psychiatric facility. I was terrified. My beautiful daughter was struggling, and you're powerless. And as I'm driving behind this ambulance, I mean, it was that day, it was like 100 degrees out. It felt like hell on earth. And then as I'm driving behind the ambulance, the sky opened up in the most torrential downpour. It was like I was driving through lightning on either side of me. Like my car was being lit up, and I'm terrified of my driving, of what's happening this day, the whole thing. And in that moment, I was crying. And I felt God next to me in the seat. I really did. I said out loud, you know, I know you're here. I believe in you. I believe in your plan. I don't like it though. I don't like it. I'm not happy with your plan. And like, I heard, I know. And like, you know, I felt like God gave me a rainy day. God gave me a torrential storm. I felt like the world was crying with me. You know, I have to say also, as a compulsive overeater, that day I prayed and meditated. I knew what I was walking into. I knew I was walking into a tough day. I went to the emergency room that day knowing it was going to be a rough day with my cooler packed, like my weighed and measured food for the day. Because, you know, and I knew that there was nothing self-centered about that, because I also brushed my teeth that day, right? And I also like put on my underwear and I put on a bra. I packed my food. It was the same kind of thing for me. And I felt like, you know, I didn't eat that day. And that whole period of time I didn't eat. And I want to tell you, my daughter's doing beautifully today. She's doing just fine. And I believe also, you know, like I showed you my pictures. I was living in that hell too, right? I know what she was going through. It was different, but I lived in hell too. And God gave me a miracle of healing. Why? Of course, there's more miracles for other people out there. My own experience has informed me of that. And I also know that what looks like the worst thing in the world is not. It's not. For me, like morbid obesity, best thing in the world that ever happened for me. Best thing. I have a life of meaning and purpose, you know, beyond anything. And I believe that my daughter will also have a life of great meaning and purpose. Thanks. So no, I have not. Thank you, God. I haven't lost my faith.
How long did it take you to really start believing and really start feeling things or feeling God's presence?
Okay, so I came in and out and in and out and in and out, right? Never felt God's presence then. The day I said, I can't stand this anymore. I will do anything. Tell me what to do. You know, something miraculous began to happen that I did begin to feel. How is it that I walked into a meeting one day on a Saturday? Who puts down food on a Saturday? Like, we always wait till Monday. And I met someone at that meeting, loving, kind, beautiful. And she said to me, she came right up to me and she said, "You ready to start?" And out of my mouth was, "Yes." And I began to have a little experience then. So I would say, you know, it happened in increments. When did I fully feel God's presence? I don't know, this morning, right now, I don't know. Comes in, you know, gets stronger and stronger and stronger.
And what are your meditation practices?
I love to meditate. So I have like a couple of different places. One, in the summer, I have a beautiful porch. I have my beautiful front porch that overlooks my garden. And I sit there and I meditate, and I've got my wind chimes and I've got like my hummingbird feeders and my bird baths, and I sit out there in nature and I can just feel God around me. And I like, there's some meditation apps I like, there's some music I like. In the winter, it's freezing in New York. I can't sit outside. I have a lovely chair in my bedroom. It's my prayer and meditation spot. It's where I go. I love music. I love nature. I'll put on specific meditation apps. I'll sit there. I set the timer. And I start with, I start with some breathing just to sort of clear myself out. I have some different breathing exercises I like. And then, I'll just start meditating on love. I just start thinking about, because we're told love and tolerance is our code. So I really start meditating on love and what that would look like. And I envision people in my life. And I just picture like love being delivered to them. And it's just a beautiful, it feels so good. And I say, like, if you're struggling to meditate, you haven't found the right one. Keep doing it. It does feel good. It does feel, it's very, yeah, it feels good. So
how long do you meditate for?
Depends on the day. Sometimes, you know, I have a prayer practice, so I do that first. But I can meditate. Sometimes it's 10 minutes, sometimes 15. If I have time, it's more. That's usually about, you know, and first I have to like stop, you know, I have to like get my mind free of the laundry list, because I don't want to meditate on my list of my to-do list. So sometimes I'll just let my brain do that. And then I'll sort of start my time when I feel like that's pushed out.
Another question is, have you relapsed at all in OA?
Not since I've recovered. When I was recovering, yes, I had many, but I had not really recovered. I never heard that word. Once I heard that word and I heard specific what it was and I got very clear directions, and I got a plan that was entirely abstinent. No, I have not, and it's gonna be 7 years. It is 7 years now, yeah.
And how do you check if your ideas are your ideas and your plan or God's plan?
Well, we're told that, self-appraisal is insufficient, right? So if I start getting an idea, if you want to also, like, I have this topic that I've discussed that I've done with recently on strengthening my spirituality, and that's done in community, right? So if I want to broaden and grow in my spiritual connection, I've got to invite other people into the dialogue. So if I get an idea and it doesn't sound quite right, it sounds like a little extreme, I've got some people whose recovery I really value and trust, and I will run it by them. I have a sponsor, right? I don't act quickly. I am slow to act these days.
And other than your meditation, what other spiritual practice do you do daily?
Pray. I mean, I have a lot of what I would call spiritual practices. Anything that keeps me in recovery, anything that I do that is spiritual, right? Is of spiritual nature, spiritual. You know, here's the difference, right? Faith is a belief, right? It's a fundamental belief that my needs will be met. And even if they're not met, that I'm going to be okay. And spirituality is the demonstration of me having those beliefs, right? So spirituality is demonstration. So it's, I strengthen my spirituality through fellowship, through meetings, through service, through sponsorship. You know, I would say a spiritual practice for me, it's like weighing and measuring my food. It's a demonstration that I trust you, God, with the amount. I'm still a compulsive overeater. I have to tell you, I weigh out my vegetables and it doesn't look like enough. I want more. I always want more. And a very, for me, a humbling spiritual experience is I weigh out, my broccoli or my blueberries. My blueberries is a perfect one. And if it goes over, I take the extra blueberry off. And for me, that's an act of spirituality. I mean, it sounds so ridiculous, but for a compulsive overeater, that's how I demonstrate it. Thanks.
Okay. All right. We have about 5 minutes more in terms of our questions, because it's 15 minutes to the hour. So if there are any more questions, please send them in. Okay, and somebody says, is it possible to have a copy of the two prayers, the one that your friend did and the one that you did about God, do you care? Are you there? And all of that.
Of course. There's my number. It's in my name there. I put it in my, I know we're being recorded, so I don't know, how that would, if I give, I'm not sure how. As far as that, but my number is there. If somebody texts me and they give me their email, I can easily email it to you. I could say my email, whatever you would like. I can share it that way.
And have you found that any type of religious practices enhance or have nothing to do with your spiritual practices? How has that worked for you?
Yeah, I do. I like some religious practices. I do. There are some that I'm very open to. I don't close. I haven't been closed off. So I've, there are certain things I like. I love lighting candles, and most religions have a candle lighting component to it. It seems to be a universal practice. I like to light candles. We do, in my faith, we have memorial candles that we light for people. But I know lots of religions do that. And I do feel, I do feel a closeness to people who have passed. when I do that, and I feel God's presence there as well.
And we have a question. Please describe what you mean by recovered.
Oh, that's great. So if you look in the 10-step promises, right? That's what it means to be. And I have a whole thing that I've done on what it means to be recovered. But first of all, I would tell you that we're supposed to be happy, joyous, and free. So if you want to find people who've recovered, they actually appear recovered. I say Ebby, even though, you know, in the big book, we're told that he did go back out again, he showed up fresh-faced, right? I say, like, people who are fresh-faced and on fire, right? And I'm going to also tell you what it means to, there are so many promises in the text, but here it is. This is what it means to be recovered. We have ceased fighting anything or anyone, even alcohol. So I don't fight the food anymore. There's no fight. I'm not interested in it. For by this time, sanity will have returned. Seldom interested in liquor. I'm seldom interested in food. You know, if tempted, I recoil as if from a hot flame. I've had a few instances where this temptation came up and I was able to, like, whoosh, recoil, say, like, this is crazy. We react sanely and normally, and we will find that this has happened automatically. It just happens. We will see that our new attitude toward liquor has been given us without any thought or effort on our part. It just comes. That's the miracle of it. We're not fighting it, neither are we avoiding temptation. We feel as though we've been placed in a position of neutrality, safe and protected. We've not even sworn off. Instead, the problem has been removed. It does not exist for us. We're neither cocky nor are we afraid. That's our experience. That is how we react, so long as we keep in fit spiritual condition. So what does it mean to be recovered? I used to live in this state where, and I used to hear this in OA, that we had to take the tiger out of the cage 3 times a day and get it back in safely. And I felt like I was always the tiger in a cage. So what I wanted from OA initially was a really, really strong cage. Give me a strong cage to contain my tiger. And that's not recovered, right? And so because what I lived like before was I always felt the bars of that cage. They felt constrictive. And what would happen for me was that the world felt like it was rattling my cage, right? Like poking me through the bars, everything triggering me, everything bothering me. And it would reach a point where it would get so constrictive and so severe that I would bust out of that cage, right? Bust out and run amok. And here's what happens when you're recovered. I don't need a cage because it's not a tiger. It's a kitten, right? That's what happens. The tiger becomes a kitten. My family can eat anything they want. Like, I've frosted a cake. I don't do it, and I don't look to do it because that's being cocky, right? That's being like pigheaded and cocky, and I don't want to be like that. But I've done it, and I've been able to do it, and it doesn't mean anything to me anymore. You know, when I was a little girl, I shared, like, my early experiences with food was my mom would take out a cake every Friday night. And before my first piece was cut, before the piece was cut, I knew my slice wasn't enough. I always knew that it was never going to be enough for me. And today, like, I don't look to, you know, I'm not looking for the cake. I live in honesty with my food. I'm happy to serve other people. That's to be recovered. Thanks.
Thank you. Unfortunately, we have no more time, although there's more questions. It's now 10 minutes to the hour, and our sharing time has come to an end. I'll now hand the meeting back to our chairperson, Penny. And thank you again so much, Melissa. That was wonderful. Okay, Penny. Okay, take it away.
Thank, Thank you, Judy. And again, thank you so much, Melissa. In closing, I would like to say that I would like to thank everyone for service in coming here, everyone who helped put this meeting together, and everyone who asked questions. And again, Melissa, for sharing. By following the 12 steps, attending meetings regularly, and using the OA tools, we are changing our lives. You will find hope and encouragement in Overeaters Anonymous. To the newcomer, we suggest at least 6 different meetings to learn the many ways OA can help you. Opinions expressed here today are those of individual OA members and do not represent OA as a whole. Please remember our commitment to honor each other's anonymity. What you hear here, whom you see here, when you leave here, let it stay here. Let us all reach out by phone or email to newcomers, returning members, and each other. Together, we get better. To close the meeting, I'm going to ask Dana P. to unmute and read the promises, which will be posted in the chat section for us all to follow along. Dana.
Thank you, Penny. Dana P., compulsive overeater. And thank you, Melissa. It's always such a pleasure to see you and hear you. And anyway, I'm going to get emotional, so I'll just go ahead and read from the bottom of page 83 on the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. If we are painstaking about this phase of our development, we will be amazed before we are halfway through. We are going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. We will not regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it. We will comprehend the word serenity and we will know peace. No matter how far down the scale we have gone, we will see how our experience can benefit others. That feeling of uselessness and self-pity will disappear. We will lose interest in selfish things and gain interest in our fellows. Self-seeking will slip away. Our whole attitude and outlook upon life will change. Fear of people and of economic insecurity will leave us. We will intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle us. We will suddenly realize that God is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. Are these extravagant promises? We think not. They are being fulfilled among us, sometimes quickly and sometimes slowly. They will always materialize if we work for them. Thank you and pass.